So welcome, everyone. This, as I mentioned, is the sixth talk in our first module on compassion. And I thought it might be helpful just to see where we are at this point. So the book we're using, as you know, is The Places That Scare You by Pema Chodron. And there are many topics in this book, but mostly we've been focusing on the four limitless ones. So the first two talks in the series were introductory talks about Buddhism in general. And then the first talk on the four limitless ones is on Maitri. And then last week, we covered compassion and the practice of Tonglen. And tonight we're going to be doing three and four, joy and equanimity. So I did want to mention one thing that actually Craig isn't here, but he brought it up last week, and he said, with meditation we notice we're thinking and come back to the breath, but you're teaching us contemplation practices, and that's what we taught with the first one, Maitri, contemplation of loving kindness, and Tonglen is also in that way. A contemplation. So it is a little different from the mindfulness practice, just to clarify that in case there's some confusion there. There are more practices on, you could say, contemplation rather than meditation, shamatha practice. So it's something different. So I thought we could start tonight by reading on page 37. The four limitless ones. And just, it is actually a chant, you could say, or a recitation. So we'll read it together. And also, in your own home practice, you could read the four limitless ones, if you wish.
May all sentient beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. May we be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May we not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. May we dwell in the great equanimity, free from compassion, aggression, and prejudice.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
When we're reading these, should we be trying to be reading in sort of a monotone or with expression?
Generally, it's done more in a monotone because I guess the style I'm used to comes from the Tibetan tradition where it's more of a monotone. Actually, there's a natural rhythm to their syllables, and there's like seven syllables to a line or something. So it has a natural flow. But the idea is sort of, it's like a continuous river. And there's not a lot of particular up and down expression. But at home, you can do whatever you want. Who cares? So these four limitless ones, they are basically describing a transformative process. And in order to work with that process, we really have to practice them. These are practices. So as opposed to just reading a book and thinking about it, these are actual practices that actually can transform your view of the world and the way you react to situations and how you see things. And it's really a very experiential process, and every person will experience it in different ways. So it's up to you, really, how you work with this. I mean, we'll be leaving this section tonight, but the practices will be ongoing. And whatever you learn here, you can just apply in any way in your life that you wish. So if you have a particular, say, one of these four limitless ones that you particularly connect with, you could just use that as a daily contemplation and see how it affects you. I really feel it takes a while for it to sink in and to start to transform your view. And it's really up to you to see and judge that. Likewise, with the practice of Tonglin that we reviewed tonight, you can just do little baby steps. You can start with something very small. And the practice of Tonglin is sending and taking. So it's basically taking in difficult situations. It could be for another person or yourself, and breathing out some kind of relief or spaciousness into that situation. So we expand, we take these situations, and then we expand out more and more. And we start including more people in our circle of compassion. And with each of the practices we've been working with, you can just start very small or with yourself, and then you can include a loved one, then you can include someone that's more of a neutral person, and then you get to include at the end more someone that's very difficult. So the practices, as you're aware, are explained in the back of the book, and you can keep working with those as well. So each step is really moving us outward and including more people in our circle of compassion. And each step is a step out of petty, self-absorbed mind. And it we undermine our own self-importance by really thinking about other people more and more. And there's a natural progression where we develop more gentleness and then fearlessness. And so this book is called The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearlessness in Difficult Times. And we haven't really talked much about the fearlessness aspect, but I think you'll discover for yourself when you start to work with these practices, you feel actually more capacity to stay with situations where there's pain and difficulty. It could be just working with it on a mental level or actually in a more active level. But the practices are conditioning us, you could say, or preparing us to be in and to work in more difficult situations. And from the practices, I think you'll find that there's more joy that actually arises naturally from that. So that's what I meant by a progression from Maitri, which is friendliness to yourself and others, to compassion, which is thinking about others' suffering and really taking that on or feeling empathy for situations, to this joy. And so tonight we're going to be talking more about joy and equanimity. And with joy, there's a sense that the heart is expanding more and the boundaries are moving further and further out. So instead of this quality of self-protection and that can be more of a shutting down, the opening actually brings joy. So there's more room to accommodate people and situations. So the third limitless quality is called joy. And when we read that one, we say, may we not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. And this joy comes from a growing appreciation of our own basic goodness. Or you could say bodhicitta. Michael mentioned that tonight in the Tonglin practice. And bodhicitta is, you could say, your core, or your fundamental being, which is good and pure and a capacity for expanding joy and love in the world and a connection with others. So this joy also comes from our ability to stay present. Pema talks about that. And also from realizing that our situation is workable. Instead of feeling, you could say, maybe on the bottom of the barrel, you start to feel like there's some vision and you've come more to the top of the barrel, and you have a sense of looking out. And because you've been working with your mind through your meditation practice and through some exercises and practice in contemplations, that also helps us in that way. So with the chapter we're working on tonight is about rejoicing. That's the first of the three. So that's chapter 10, finding the ability to rejoice. And Pema talks about, at first, well, she goes through more than one step. She doesn't go through all seven, but the first is learning to rejoice at our own good fortune. So sometimes we may think of everything that's wrong or difficult or negative, but this in a way reverses that so that we can actually take joy in very small things and very things that are close to us. A glass of water, for instance, or a delicious pear, or just looking at a raindrop hanging off a branch that's actually reflecting the sun. And those moments are very brief, but they actually can add up, you could say, I guess. There's a sense of appreciation for things in the world, and that, I think, expands to more and more joy because those things are always available to us no matter what our situation is or our state of mind or our physical condition. I was thinking about this winter, which has been quite cold, and there was that one day that it warmed up just enough for the Charles River was melting a little bit, and I walked over to the river because I live quite near the river on Prospect Street, and the ducks were in there and they were just flapping around like this and shaking, and you could see there was just this joy. They were before confined to this one little area where the river was open and they were always on the ice, and then all of a sudden they had this expansion. So I was taking great joy in that situation. And I think we have that opportunity all the time. So just highlighting a practice like this and just working with a practice like this can bring it back home and make it more alive for us. But tonight we're not going to do the fun stuff. I have to warn you. We've been pretty easy on you. I'd like to work with a situation with joy around an enemy because it's hardest to work with a situation around someone that you have a lot of difficulty with, or you in this exercise, you could actually think of a person who's a public enemy or caused a lot of pain and suffering to many people in the world, or you know, it could be a situation that's past where there's still some lingering resentment or fear or dislike or intense hatred even. So we're going to do that exercise now. So you can try to think, and also if this feels like too much for you, you can just back off and think of a less intense situation. So you can just make that decision for yourself. So just bring up a situation. You can close your eyes. And bring up a person that has caused you great difficulty and that you would naturally not feel that you would want to offer any joy to this person or to rejoice in that person's good fortune. But bring up any situation where someone might be called your enemy or someone who'd caused you pain or difficulty. And just take a moment to breathe in that situation. Just breathe with that situation. It's not Tonglen, you're not breathing it in. But just breathe and be present. And now offer that person joy as best you can. Offer joy and well-being. And take a moment to feel what that's bringing up for you. And if you're able to drop the storyline of how whatever happened in the situation that causes this pain, and just drop the storyline and feel in your body, in your heart, what you're feeling now. Back. I'm wondering if anyone would like to share their reaction or has any comments on how that was for them. Yeah.
It feels like a relief.
Oh.
Being able to neutralize my feeling. Feels like a relief, and it feels generous,
mm-hmm.
and it feels kind. It frees me too.
Mm-hmm.
Besides just good vibes,
mm-hmm.
it feels like it frees me too.
Mm-hmm. Because you don't have to hang on to the negativity so much. Can release that.
I find it too. I'm not able to really let go of the negativity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of, I can't do the Tom Lennon, stuck at the compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I can do that at all. And I'm like, okay, you know, may this person be free of suffering or may this person enjoy. So it'll be easier for me to manage. This person won't cause me so much trouble. It's
mm-hmm.
just really hard.
Mm-hmm. But that's where you are, and that's exactly the point. Start where you are. And that's real. That's it.
Yeah.
That's just fine. That's
I'm
just fine.
Cradle.
What?
I'm in the cradle.
That's, well, that's fine. We all are.
Starting this, I just sort of felt like I'm trying to wish them joy. Well, I can... not wish them harm, but I wish them joy is really hard. And then I tried to step back and eventually just sort of name the feelings, which may be too intellectual. Once I named the feelings that had been generated, it,
mm-hmm.
I'm still not sure I got to the point of wishing them joy, but it got a little easier.
That's okay. And how was the naming the feelings? Did that? What was the effect of that?
That made it easier because then I can just sort of say, okay, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think the losing the story loses my self-righteousness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think when I named the feelings, I guess it was like fear and I felt threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really where it came from.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if maybe I'm not doing this with the right attitude, but I'm thinking of myself. I'm thinking, wow, I let go of the rope. I'm free.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's the full intention of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. Of really wishing them well. Because when it's somebody that's really, letting go of the rope frees me.
Right.
So maybe that's a step in the mm-hmm. right direction.
Right.
It's not
that's
completely
one.
Like opening my arms and, I hope they have a wonderful life.
Right.
I'm not quite there, but it's the step.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
right.
It does.
This is an aspiration, mm-hmm. not an accomplishment.
Yeah. Okay.
That's an important distinction.
Yes.
We talked about aspiration before, how this is so much a part of this teaching and this practice is aspiration. We're aspiring to be able to reach that point. I mean, we jumped from just trying to like actually make friends with ourselves, people to put up with ourselves and what we see, and then maybe people who we love but really find really irritating in many ways, and other people who we don't love and find irritating, but then there's another step, I think, also, and that has to do with rejoicing when you realize that other people have it good. I mean, now, that doesn't mean by society standards or somebody else, but by recognizing that there are many people in this world who are genuinely happy, and, you know, rejoicing in their happiness is very good. When you if that is genuine happiness and it's coming from the alignment we talk about with it, from, you know, our fundamental essence, quality, the essence and the nature and reality, then this is glorious. And people who have been able to do this and bring happiness to others, so that's a lot to rejoice in. I mean, this is a real big jump.
This is a big jump. I skipped on purpose.
Yeah,
I didn't want it to be too easy. But it's true. There's a natural progression. So in a way, we're kind of going fast here. There's no reason to go fast particularly. But I think it's good to see the whole spectrum. So I wanted to go to the enemy just for you to experience that. As almost the extreme, but it's the hardest to do, obviously. And it's really, as Michael said, I mean, there's a progression, and there's you kind of work up to that. But in some ways, when you go to the end, you can see your own reaction more clearly, and it's more vivid.
So you know what you're working with.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we're talking about ultimately rejoicing in someone's good fortune, no matter where they are on the spectrum. You know, your child that you love very much, your grandmother, the woman in the grocery store that you barely know, and down the line, you know, so that you can feel others' good fortune, which you're really just connecting with that on many different levels. But when you bring up an enemy, which you can do along the way with each one of these four practices, that's the last step, you could say. And you really made a good point, Mary, when you're talking about how you felt about yourself, and I don't know if I'm really being 100% generous to that person. And you can see you can feel the distinction there and that edge, but you can keep working with that. So it is an aspiration, and it comes in its own time too, in a way. And you just notice how it affects you. So in a way, we're covering all four in this kind of short module, but it will continue to be a practice that you'll carry with you and keep working with all along the way. And we'll revisit it again, too. We can revisit, you know, go back and work on these more.
Seems like the opposite of the German word Schadenfreude.
Oh, yes, Schadenfreude. Yeah. Be happy that that person's suffering.
Yeah, you wish them not to suffer.
Right.
But I do have a question. You're mm-hmm. Particularly if you wanted to go and apply this to sort of the historical evil people, if you want to use that terminology, is there any accountability when you're wishing somebody joy who has done terrible things?
It's not dismissing what they've done,
okay.
Or it's not saying it's all okay, but you're basically seeing that person's basic goodness as well, even though the actions were very harmful.
Okay, it's sort of like the antithesis of the scout troop that took away Timothy McVeigh's Eagle Scout.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what he did. Okay, it's sort of saying.
It's like in some way, as we learn more about Buddha nature, we realize all beings possess this nature. And so even the darkest people who ever showed up on this planet and wreaked the most havoc and mayhem still are fundamentally Buddha nature.
Okay.
We can rejoice in that. So, you know, sometimes you'll have a day when suddenly you just feel really great. I mean, like today with like the sun breaking out of the clouds, and you were up doing this thing in the mountain. And, you know, it's like really spacious. And, you know, it's easy at that point to actually extend that out to. And so what you're extending it out to is not forgiving everybody for being a jerk or anything. But, we talked about idiot compassion. We're not doing that. We're talking about actually learning how to fundamentally rejoice in just what being is. And so it's up for us to be able to make good or bad use of it, which is what we do. But we still can rejoice in that fundamental ultimate essence, and that's part of what this rejoicing in other people, regardless of who they are.
So does that keep us apart from seeing gloom, that will affect us? It's the other side of that is that we look for that crack in the sky, that bright Buddha nature that in essence reflects back on ourselves and contributes to our own sense of peace and well-being by offering a recognition of the basic good nature that might lie within darkness, or so the hope.
The sun's behind the clouds, anyway.
Yeah, the sun's behind the clouds.
But it's never about, you know, sweeping things under the rug, or it's not Pollyanna, you know, like, oh, it's going to be okay, even though, I mean, there are horrific things that happen. We all know that. We know all the horrible things that have happened through history. It's not dismissing any of those or saying that didn't happen, or, you know, it's okay. It's actually realizing fundamentally the basic goodness in every person, and then the mistakes, you could say, or the fundamental lack of understanding of people that cause them then to cause such great harm in the world. I was thinking in our example today about what happened at the Boston Marathon, and I was thinking about, you know, one boy was killed and the other is, I don't know where he is at this point, in prison, but I mean, people lost their legs. I mean, and I was just really contemplating as we were doing this the horror of that situation. And I have to say that I felt a lot of confusion towards that. So, you know, that's where I ended up. I didn't have any kind of resolution. I just ended up with confusion. So it's really seeing the situation for what it is, for where you are, I guess, you know. And we can work with it. Yes.
I was just thinking when you were talking about, you know, the difficulty of wishing an evil person happiness, but I was just thinking that for that evil person to be happy, they would have to no longer be evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You couldn't be that evil person and be happy, so if you're projecting happiness to that evil person, then if it's not, you know, if it's somebody in your life or that harmed you in your life or whatever, and you're projecting happiness, you're projecting a transformation of that person to become somebody that wouldn't harm other people or hurt other people. So I think it's just in that larger context, it's like, you know, it's almost a dream of a better world, or of that person transforming into a better person or something like that, because otherwise they wouldn't be happy.
But it's not your responsibility to engineer it also.
No.
Yeah.
Basically, because it's not about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're wishing them happiness.
It's not about you, but it is, I mean, it is about you. because it's your internal.
Your reaction is about you.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's okay. I mean, I was thinking when I did it, I was thinking about the usual candidates, Stalin, Hitler, people like
that. Oh, yeah. Hitler comes up first.
The more I thought about it, I mean, the more I had a sense of heaviness that just, you know, but I, at the same time, I felt like, well, I mean, I'm opening myself up to that, and I'm not going to be shirking or feeling like I shouldn't be feeling this way, but I'm opening to it completely, and I'm offering. And so this is a kind of an aspiration. You know, we can't undo what did happen, but, you know, I think somehow the point of being open is the problem we have is, and this is why these teachings are specifically engineered toward our practices, because we shut down because of these things instead of being open. And without being open, we cannot accomplish any real good in this world. And, you know, that's kind of the way it works.
So I'd like to go on to equanimity, and then we can have more discussion too. We have time here. So the fourth immeasurable is equanimity, and that is, may we dwell in the great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. That's the fourth immeasurable. So this word equanimity means mental calmness, composure, and evenness of temper, especially in difficult situations. So there's a sense of meeting what comes with a sense of composure and openness. So these three in this line are passion, aggression, and prejudice. And what's interesting, in Buddhism, there are teachings about the three poisons, and those are passion, aggression, and ignorance. So I want to talk about those words, because those will come up, or you'll find them over and over again. So in this case, passion doesn't mean, you know, if someone says, oh, I'm passionate about my work, no, that's not a problem. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about what leads you to attachment or holding on, that would be drawing things into yourself and wanting to hold on. So there's a more of a sense of desire under that. So the passion doesn't mean excitement about something that's meaningful to you, but it's more of attachment is really a clearer word perhaps. And aggression is taught as pushing away. Aggression is that which we push away. So what we have passion for is what we're drawing in. What we have aggression towards is what we're pushing away. So we think of anger often as part of that. And then ignorance is basically ignoring a situation and not you know, just completely kind of shutting down within that situation. In this case, with equanimity, may we dwell in the great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. Prejudice is prejudge. So as we're talking about equanimity, it's about not being open to a situation. And you could take it further and say it's not being able to see the commonality of all people, for instance. I mean, we often use prejudice as prejudice towards a certain person or race or religion or something like that. So the quote in chapter 12, I think, is very interesting. It's right at the top of the page. And this is page 69. Mm-hmm. Marty, do you want to read that for us?
Train without bias in all areas. It is crucial always to do this pervasively and wholeheartedly.
Good, thanks. That's from the mind training slogan of Atisha. And we'll be working more with mind training slogans. So I thought this was great because it's train without bias. So that really says also what equanimity is. Train without bias, wholeheartedly. pervasively and wholeheartedly. So when we learn to practice shamatha meditation, peaceful abiding, one of the most important instructions is when we see or notice that we're thinking, we drop the thought and come back to the breath, come back to the out-breath. And we drop the thought without judgment. So we don't analyze, that was a good thought, that was a bad thought, that was a good meditation, that was a bad meditation, I'm doing it wrong, I'll never get it right, all I have is too many thoughts. It's equanimity towards our own practice is where we actually lay the ground for this and to carry it further into our life. So when the thoughts arise, it's just thinking. And it's just thinking. Whatever arises, and you come back to the breath. So that's the beginning of our training in equanimity right there. And that's how we begin to tame our mind. So we're going also beyond like and dislike and good and bad and all the judgments that we make when we work with the practice. So that carries further. So this training then helps us develop equilibrium. And equilibrium is a stability of mind that doesn't depend on external circumstances. So as you practice more, there's a sense of, as things come, okay. As things go, okay. And there's a, I think it's here when she talks about the Zen teacher who, when they'd ask the teacher, well, how are you today? He said, oh, I'm okay. And then the student knew he was having a really bad situation happen, whatever it was. And he'd say, how are you today? And he'd say, oh, I'm okay. So there, it's not that you don't feel things, but there's more sense of equanimity in your life in terms of what comes to you. Because I think there's more sense that you can work with things, and fundamentally there's more stability. So I wanted to also speak a little bit about something Pema puts here on page, it's on page 70. We have a little time, so I'll read this little section here. The second paragraph. Equanimity is bigger than our usual limited perspective, that we hope to get what we want and fear losing what we have. This describes our habitual predicament. The Buddhist teachings identify 8 variations on this tendency to hope and fear. Pleasure and pain, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disgrace. As long as we're caught in one of these extremes, the potential for the other is always there. They just chase each other around. No lasting happiness comes from being caught in this cycle of attraction and aversion. We can never get life to work out so that we eliminate everything we fear and end up with all the goodies. Therefore, the warrior bodhisattva cultivates equanimity, the vast mind that doesn't narrow reality into for and against, liking and disliking. And actually, the next sentence is really great, too. To cultivate equanimity, we practice catching ourselves when we feel attraction or aversion before it hardens into grasping or negativity. So these are called the 8 worldly dharmas. And there's actually a lot in them, which you can contemplate a little more. But they're pairs, as you know here, from these 4. So pleasure and pain, we're often trying to get what's pleasurable and push away what's painful. Praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disgrace. So it's saying that we could actually take a bigger perspective. Not that we wouldn't react, or not that we don't necessarily prefer pleasure over pain, perhaps. It's hard to say. I'm not selling anything else here. But actually, it's going beyond getting stuck in either of these, because ultimately they cause suffering, because pleasure eventually changes. It doesn't stay. So again, the equanimity aspect is finding more evenness within our situation. So the equanimity training pervades all the four immeasurables. And as we know, when we practice, we gradually move from the bias of those we like to those we find difficult. And we can use every opportunity to train in going beyond our usual approach to accepting and rejecting. So another way of applying this particular immeasurable, the fourth one on equanimity, it's another way that these are taught is to apply the fourth one first, the equanimity first. So you train in equanimity, and then all the others basically are related to that. So in a way, they're always intertwined. In a way, equanimity belongs in all of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I still sometimes am wondering, because having a life without passion, with, you know, and you know, when we know when you fall in love, when you love someone, there's always a risk of loss. And so if you're willing to balance, to not, to try to avoid the kind of, to not embrace the pleasure because you know you're going to eventually feel pain, I'm not sure that...
No, it's not to shut that down.
Okay.
No, and certainly there is passion and love, and mm-hmm. it's not that you're shutting that off. It's just you're realizing that you're, instead of grasping in the situation. So it's more of open, it's more open, and therefore it's more free, I think. Does that make sense?
I think so. I know so many people uh-huh. say, like, I'll never get another pet because it hurts so much when they die.
Oh, yes.
And so...
Well, that's part of the bargain, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's in there. It's not that we're avoiding the situation. Does anyone else want to comment on that?
Yeah,
Michael?
Well, to be open is to say, yes, I'm going to get that pet because I have this passion for the pet.
Mm-hmm.
When the pet dies, there's pain.
Yeah.
So I'm accepting that there's pleasure and accepting that there's pain, as opposed to saying, I'm going to shut down the pleasure because I don't want the pain that comes later. That's not... It's being open to whatever flows through.
Okay, so it's not avoiding
no.
necessarily. Okay, because I was thinking it was to avoid the extremes, and that seemed like that's not really living.
No, because that's bland.
If you try to protect, like for instance, a love affair, because you know you're nervous about it dissolving, then you start to block the flow of creative energy in there because you're assuming you know what's possible instead of being open to this freedom that allows all sorts of things to arise, and that includes pleasurable and painful experiences. And without both, there's no reality to the relationship. It's just you're living in a bubble.
Right. That's right. Okay, that makes much more sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
The use of the term passion, maybe it would be better. What you're talking about is obsession. That's the part of passion in which I you grasp.
Uh huh. Yes.
Grasp.
It's sort of your hooks are in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't only obsession, because obsession is really extreme. Mm-hmm. We're talking about all the little attachments that we have about everything. And that's as we learn how to unpeel the layers of so-called me, mm-hmm. you know, because we are working on, we introduced this and we haven't really emphasize this too much. This is emphasizing it from another angle about egolessness, about learning how to strip away the layers of ego and these notions of what me and mine is. That part of this is, and this is why it's considered one of the chief poisons, because all of our little attachments are forms of grasping. And we don't realize how deeply rooted we are in grasping. It's part of being in this desire realm. So it's very pervasive, but we start on the stuff that we can actually see is attachment, and then you know we can begin to understand how obsession is something where the whole thing gets completely out of control, and one just gives up any kind of personal relationship to the thing because it's this other thing that takes over is fixation, the other fixation.
So this is about being more daring.
Okay.
Yeah, not less daring, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how you handle your passions, yeah.
I had a little bit of an opposite thing going on with me in that I was attached to non-attachment. I was getting obsessed with, you know, I won't get attached to that because that's not so-called spiritual on my path. And so I saw everything in a, okay, well, if I'm spiritual, suffering is natural and I'm supposed to suffer. And I'll be comfortable with suffering. And so I wasn't going towards more middle,
mm-hmm.
or more comfortable, or even more passionate in the good sense.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of stuck. So I was wondering if you had a comment on that.
Well, this is it's really good you brought that up, because actually we're going to continue with this book,
uh-huh.
and I get to sign the chapter, so I'm giving Michael this one. This is one of the hardest ones coming up. Poor Michael. That chapter is, it's called Meeting the Enemy, chapter 13. And they're the near and far enemies of the four immeasurable. And it's very powerful because, so for instance, with compassion, the near enemy is pity, overwhelm, and idiot compassion. And the far enemy is cruelty. So you're talking here about, I don't know if that fits into this actually, about suffering and pushing that away.
It almost felt like martyrdom.
Yeah.
You know, it felt like that, like, okay, well, I'm spiritual, I'm not supposed to want anything, I'm supposed to be of service, I'm not supposed to need anything, but underneath that, in my belly, was getting frustrated.
Yeah, we also call that spiritual materialism.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
Right. That's the view. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not being genuine either.
I wasn't being.
It's
genuine.
It's not genuine.
No, I was floating around.
Right.
And, I'm helping, and I don't need anything, but it wasn't true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's coming from an idea, not from the reality.
Not from. Yeah.
So the interesting thing about Buddhism is, that's why you combine the meditation practice with the study as well, because the meditation practice will reveal to you what's really underneath and what you're doing. If you start to develop prajna, we used that word before, and prajna, P-R-A-J-N-A, prajna is this clear seeing, and you start to see what your patterns are and where your confusion is. And it more and more you start to have a sense of what's happening, and you start to reflect on that, and then you adjust, you can do something different.
Yeah. Good luck next week.
Yeah. Poor Michael.
Next week we're going to have a video.
Right. He gets 2 weeks off.
Oh,
he gets
okay.
1 week off.
Yeah.
And he has to do
video
this.
Pema
Chodron.
Pema Chodron being
interviewed by Bill Moyers.
Yep.
And it's very well done because it's professional TV, and it was done several years ago. But it's great. I mean, she has great answers to questions, general questions he asks about Buddhism. It's 50 minutes. So we'll do our usual meditation, and then we'll have that video. And then we'll be continuing with the book. So we'll be on chapter 13 next week. And I would recommend that you make a little chart. That's what I did. The four immeasurables. I did the four immeasurables on one side, the near enemies and the far enemies. And it's quite profound, this chapter, because what this chapter is how we get hooked and how we get stuck. So we may have some view of, oh, I should be more compassionate. And actually my response to working with compassion was feeling overwhelmed. and then shutting down and turning away. So I realized that that's often my style. Like, you start to see your basic style in avoidance. And for loving kindness, attachment is the near enemy, and the far enemy is hatred and aversion, which is interesting. So study, you know, read it and see what you think and contemplate it. We'll just be doing that one chapter. That will be in 2 weeks. And then we'll be continuing on through this book.
Okay, so we can put that on the website. We can make
yes. Right, we have to update the website with that. Does anyone have any questions about the Tonglen practice? And were you able to work with that at all last week? Or how is that for you?
I really appreciated the practice tonight, sort of making it more concrete. And so I'll play with that this week.
Yeah,
Tonglen is concrete. It basically takes an idea. It's not joy in general or something. It's a particular situation that you're involved in, that you've seen or are involved in.
And you can, if you don't have to take the hardest situation, as we know, that's how we work with all of these. There's one story that Pema Chodron tells in one of her books, and this mother had a child who was a heroin addict, and she said, "I really would like to be able to do Tonglen for my son, but I just can't do it. It's just so overwhelming, the whole situation." And so Pema says, "Well, you know, is there any other situation you could use? And, you know, is there a baseball team in your town?" She goes, "Yeah." She said, "Why don't you do Tonglen for when the home team loses?" So, I mean, she had no investment in such a thing. So that was how she started, you know. And so the point is, there's always a way in. And so even when the practice seems really hard, or it's something, and then that's information too. If you turn away from a practice and you don't want to do it and you find it's overwhelming, is there a way in? Is there something more moderate or easy that you can choose? So the point is just to experiment and see. And sometimes you may resonate more with one practice rather than another. And I think the reason, usually when you start with a group, we wouldn't normally start with these kind of practices. I think Michael sort of referred to that. But that seemed to be what, people were wanting from the community here, so we just start with that, and then you can work with it at whatever level feels right for you.
I had a little difficulty with the practice myself, aside from that I hadn't chosen in advance because I was talking to everyone else. But so I did pick a friend who's been in a wheelchair all his life, and now he has an additional problem. That is, powerful arms, which are the source of his mobility, gave out with such arthritis in both of them that it basically immobilized him. So that's, and it's a person I care very much about. And I started to work on that, and I took in the suffering of that, which was easy. I can feel that very strongly. But then when I gave out equanimity and peace, the problem was that he already has more of that than I do. He is such a remarkable person. So that was a strange experience.
One of the difficulties I had is when Tonglen, if I'm taking in somebody's misery and taking it in and trying to breathe out doing that for a while, it felt I could do this, but what I had trouble was just shutting it off when we were finished and going back to meditating. I couldn't just suddenly block it out of my mind.
Well, you're not blocking it. You're actually bringing it into the meditation at that point. So at that point, you just use your meditation practice as a means to go forward, and it will wear itself out.
Which is why you
eventually.
Yeah, that's why you want to sandwich these practices with meditation on both sides.
Then you can look at these thoughts of the thinking again.
Right. There's space around it. So it's very important to have that space around it before and after. So let's say if you were going to practice for 20 minutes, well, let's say you were doing a half an hour practice. You could do 10 minutes of shamatha, 10 minutes of tonglen, and 10 minutes of shamatha at the end. So you know, if you're having a shorter practice, you would just do less of each. But the main thing is that there's enough space around the tonglen for exactly what you described. There's a sense of transition back. And this was a short.
I appreciate what Jerry's saying, because if what you're doing is you're going, you're broadening, getting bigger and bigger, and suddenly you have this universe and the next universe to step out of the cosmos and back into a simple meditation.
Right.
It's a big step, so a big transition.
Well, actually, we usually use a gong. Well, we could do it with the gong next time
when
we do it. So the tonglen practice, usually you start with shamatha, and that's you start with the gong. Then you go into tonglen by two strikes on the gong. That's a signal. Boom, boom. Well, I'll do it right now. You can go. And then you begin your tonglen. And at the end, there's something called a roll down. And that's a certain sequence on the gong that goes on for quite some time.
Oh,
so it's like a ball bouncing. Boom, 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 boom. And there are two of those. So it's a gradual return. And that probably would actually help. It's interesting how these techniques, they really thought about these things to make it easier for us. So next time we do tonglen, we'll incorporate the gong, because it's a signal and it helps you make the transition rather than just a voice command of, okay, now do this. So we'll introduce
we'll
that next
that.
Time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I actually needed a little practice before doing it publicly, I felt.
Okay. Oh, you thought of it, but you didn't bring it up.
I didn't mention it.
That's okay. That's okay. It's not the most essential thing, and so we'll incorporate that next time. So I think I would like to just read one thing from here to close. This is, this in a way is to me quite a summary of the Four Limitless Ones. And this story is what's so great about Pema Chodron is she puts great stories in her books. This is from Taking the Leap, Freeing Ourselves from Old Habits and Fears. In the book, The Search for a Nonviolent Future by Michael Nagler, there's a story that illustrates this, which is, I think, prejudice. It concerns a Jewish couple, Michael and Julie Weiser, but it could have been any victim of prejudice and violence. The Weisers were living in Lincoln, Nebraska, where Michael had a prominent role at the synagogue and Julie was a nurse. In 1992, they began to receive threatening phone calls and notes from the Ku Klux Klan. Of course, this was illegal at the time and not condoned in this town, but nevertheless, it was happening. The police told them that it was probably the work of Larry Trapp. He was the Grand Dragon, the head of the Klan in that town. Michael and Julie Weiser knew of Trapp's reputation as a man filled with hatred. And they knew that he was in a wheelchair, having been disabled by a beating years ago. Each day, Larry's voice on the phone would threaten to kill them, destroy their property, and harm their family and friends. Then one day, Michael decided, just on the spot with the support of Julie, to try something. So in the next phone call, when Larry Trapp was ranting at them, he waited for an opportunity to speak. He knew that Trapp had a hard time getting around in his wheelchair, so when he could get a word in, he offered him a ride to the grocery store. Trapp didn't speak for a while, and when he did, the anger had left his voice. He said, "Well, I've got that taken care of, but thanks for asking." By then, the Weisers had more in mind than ending the harassment. They wanted to help free Larry Trapp from the torment of his prejudice and rage. They began calling him and told him if he needed help, they would be there for him. Not long after that, they went to his apartment, taking him a home-cooked dinner, and the three of them got to know one another better. And he did begin to ask them for help. One day, when they arrived for a visit, Trapp took off the ring he wore and gave it to them. It was a Nazi ring. With that gesture, he was breaking his association with the Ku Klux Klan, telling the Weisers, "I denounce everything they stand for, but it's not the people in the organizations that I hate. If I were to say I hate all Klansmen because they're Klansmen, I would still be a racist." Rather than replacing one prejudice with another, Larry Trapp chose to let go of closed-mindedness altogether. Whoa. That takes courage.
Yeah.
That's courage. Good. And that's being a warrior. And that's going to the places that scare you and really working with these situations. So I just was very moved by that story. I wanted to share it with you. So let's dedicate the merit. Okay. By this merit may all attain perfect awakening, rising above all forces of negativity, going beyond the turbulence of birth, old age, sickness, and death. May all beings be free from the ocean of samsara.